Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to today's program, an important part of the World Affairs Council's ongoing effort to provide critical public and private sector perspectives on the issues that are shaping our world. My name is Doug B. Ryder, and I'm the President and CEO of the Asia Foundation, as well as a trustee of the World Affairs Council. We're honored to have with us today two very distinguished economists, Dr. Barry Eichengreen and Dr. Srinivasa Mudhur. We thank you both for being with us today. Before we begin, let me say a quick word about the two organizations which organized the event today. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors interested and involved in international affairs can gather. It helps members of the public participate in programs that deepen understanding and inform citizen action. To learn more about the Council, please visit the website at www.itsyourworld.org. The Asia Foundation, headquartered in San Francisco with 18 offices in Asia, is committed to the development of a peaceful, prosperous, just, and open Asia-Pacific region. The Foundation supports programs in Asia that help improve governance, law and civil society, women's empowerment, economic reform and development, and international relations. To learn more about the Asia Foundation, please visit the website at www.asiafoundation.org. Please take a moment to turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices that might interrupt our program. While you're doing that, I'd like to point out one or two upcoming programs that might be of interest to you. On Wednesday, June 30th, join the Council in welcoming Ian Bremmer, President of the Eurasia Group, for a discussion on the increasing importance of state capitalism and its negative impact on the free market system. This event will be held here in the Council Auditorium at 6 p.m., again, June 30th. Finally, you will see that there are blue question cards that were placed on your tables. During the program, you can write your questions and hand them to Council staff members who will be located throughout the room. Now I'd like to turn things over to today's moderator, Nina Merchant. Nina is our very capable Assistant Director of the Economic Reform and Development Program at the Asia Foundation. She's an experienced development economist with expertise in economic impact evaluation. Please welcome, for your moderation, Nina Merchant. Nina?
Thank you, Doug. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guests. First, Dr. Srinivasa Mudhur is the Senior Director of the Asian Development Bank's Office of Regional Economic Integration. Before taking up this position in November 2006, Dr. Mudhur worked as the bank's country economist for China, Korea, and the Philippines. Prior to joining the Asian Development Bank in 1994, Dr. Mudhur served as economic advisor to several ministries in the government of India. He also served as a member of the Economic Advisory Council to the Indian Prime Minister, as well as a consultant to the World Bank, the United Nations, and the OECD. Dr. Barry Eichengreen is the George and Helen Pardee Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, where he has taught since 1987. Dr. Eichengreen is a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research and a research fellow of the Center for Economic Policy Research in London. From 1997 to 1998, he was a senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund. Professor Eichengreen is a convener of the Bellagio Group of Academics and Economic Officials and chair of the Economic Advisory Committee of the Peterson Institute of International Economics. He is also a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Here today to discuss a framework to strengthen Asia's regional institutional architecture, please join me in welcoming Dr. Srinivasa Mudhur and Barry Eichengreen.
Thank you.
Yes.
Go there and speak.
Yeah, I think wherever you're comfortable.
I need a computer.
You can buy.
Center. Thank you, Nina, and good afternoon to everyone. And we are very pleased that. We have this great opportunity to share our views on a book that we would be publishing in a couple of months from now in this particular joint program. And so first of all, I should thank the World Affairs Council as well as the Asia Foundation for organizing this particular event and giving us the opportunity to share our thoughts on this particular project. This project was done by a joint team of staff from the Asian Development Bank and, of course, external consultants. The external consultants team was headed by Barry Eichengreen, our lead consultant for the project, who is almost single-handedly responsible for putting this report together, taking the various perspectives from the external consultants as well as from the Asian Development Bank's staff and management. So this project, the title of this book, when it will be published in a couple of months, is going to be Institutions for Asian Integration Toward an Asian Economic Community. So my task here in this introductory remarks is to provide a short background as to why this study, we have done this study, and what the background, and especially what the Asian Development Bank is all about, and why we are interested in a project like this. So the outline of my 10-minute presentation is, why should Asia integrate? What more needs to be done in the coming years and decades? Why institutions for integration, and why are we focusing in this particular study on building institutions for Asian integration? And in a very nutshell, what is the study all about? And finally, why ADB is interested in issues of this nature and this particular project. On Asian integration, the rationale, I don't want to spend too much time on this issue. We have discussed in very great detail in a book that the Asian Development Bank published in 2008. The title of that book is Emerging Asian Regionalism, A Partnership for Shared Prosperity. It's published by the bank. It's available in the bank as well as, I'm sure, it's available in our website. Now, to cut the entire arguments in favor of Asian integration to short, the book argued basically that it has more main reasons why Asia should integrate. One, of course, to deal with cross-border issues of a public good nature, which has spillovers, for example, communicable disease control, natural disaster management, and even climate change, which all have spillovers from one country to another, and hence certainly those issues need to be discussed and dealt with at a regional level, not at country level alone. And similarly, the spillovers, as many of you perhaps would be aware, during the 1997-98 Asian financial crisis, what originated in one country as a small, short currency crisis, a mild currency crisis in the beginning, of course, then became a major financial crisis and spread almost across East Asia, and especially many of the Southeast Asian countries, including, of course, Korea, which had just then become a member of OECD. So we realized how important macroeconomic spillovers of that kind are across countries, and certainly, therefore, countries need to pay attention to managing these spillovers, and hence they need to do things together and cooperate on economic policies. And finally, of course, it perhaps is a good thing for both Asia and for the world if, in keeping with the growing importance of Asia's economy in the global economy, to speak with one voice on issues where countries have a common position, rather than giving conflicting and somewhat fragmented views on global governance and economic policy issues. So overall, therefore, the conclusion from that study is that Asian integration is good for the countries involved, good for the region, that's Asia, and of course, good for the rest of the world. The vision that we developed in that book was that of a broadly called Asian economic community over the long term, which has four basic components. Integrating production. Already in Asia, there is what is called an Asia Factory Asia, emerging with strong supply chains and production networks developing across countries. And you know, you just go around any of the department stores in the U.S. or even in Europe, I hardly find it pretty difficult not to find something made in somewhere in Asia. And of course, more often than not, nowadays it's made in China. We went a bit of shopping around yesterday. We couldn't avoid but having that particular stamp on almost everything that was there in the department store. So that's the production network that Asia has developed. So obviously taking that further into the other sub-regions in Asia is a key vision for Asian integration. And similarly, integrating financial markets. During the 97-98 Asian financial crisis, we realized that Asia lacked vibrant capital markets, and hence the currency crisis, which originated in Thailand, suddenly became both a currency and a banking crisis, as they would call it, a twin crisis in Asia. And one of the reasons, as many experts have said before, was the lack of vibrant capital markets. In the very telling words of the then Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, that he referred to it as that Asia lacked a spare wheel in the form of vibrant capital markets. So integrating capital markets and developing vibrant, deep, and liquid capital markets, therefore, is a second key component of this Asian economic community. Similarly, of course, managing macroeconomic independence, because policies, whether it is monetary or fiscal, needs to be cooperated and coordinated if you want coherence at the regional level. So at the end of it all, why are we interested in Asian integration? Not just for the sake of it, but at the end of it to have to promote sustainable economic growth in the region, and also to make a particular growth very inclusive so that everybody shares in that growth. Much as Asia has grown very rapidly over the last few decades, you also would be aware that Asia is home to the largest number of poor in the world. So it has come a long way, but it's a long way to go in terms of this. So integration, we think, and we have argued in the earlier work, is good for Asia promoting social and economic and social inclusion too. The institutional landscape, Barry will deal with it in greater detail, so I don't want to deal with this particular issue. In one line, currently the institutional landscape for Asian integration in Asia, we have done a stock taking, and Barry will talk about it more. In one line, it is quite dense in the sense that we have in some sense, far too many institutions aimed for Asian integration or with the agenda of Asian integration, but at the same time, it's institutional light in the sense that many of these institutions are loose, informal, and at times, at best, intergovernmental forums without firm commitment to the regional agenda. So that's the key reason why we think in Asia needs to strengthen the existing regional institutions for integration, as well as then focus on developing newer ones. Barry will speak more about it later. Issues addressed in this particular study, basically, we first take stock of what has happened in Asian integration over the last couple of decades, and especially in the post-crisis or post-1997 Asian financial crisis years. Then we go on to look at the role of institutions for integration. Why does Asia need institutional strengthening, including strengthening existing ones and developing new ones, if Asia has to promote integration in the next stages? some people do think that it has done well until now. Why don't you just continue business as usual? But we provide the rationale as to why we need stronger institutions for Asian integration in the years to come and in the decades to come. And of course, we do a stocktaking of existing Asian institutions, anatomy of Asian institutions, and we look at what lessons can Asia learn from other regions in the world, whether it's Europe or Latin America or Africa, in terms of our own agenda of strengthening institutions for Asian integration. And based on those lessons and Asia's own needs, we finally come up with forward-looking recommendations as to what should Asia do in the years and the decades ahead in terms of building institutions for Asian integration. Barry will deal with all these issues in more detail in his presentation. Why ADB? We are a regional development bank. One of the key items in our agenda when the bank was established in 1966 was to promote cooperation regional coordination on development issues. For those of you who perhaps do not know us very much, I should tell you that we basically provide four kinds of, we play four kinds of role in the area of regional economic integration. One is we play the role of a catalyst, a coordinator for our member countries, and regional forums. There are various regional forums that we have in Asia in terms of just helping them bring together on the discussion and debate table so that we facilitate discussion and debate on policies of regional interest, issues of regional dimension. We call ourselves honest broker because we don't have a vested interest in doing that, and countries realize that we are a regional development bank, and the only reason why we want to bring them together is to help them talk to each other and sort out differences and then come up with an agenda for cooperation at a regional level over the coming years. And of course, we are a bank, we are a development bank, and we provide finance for projects for regional integration. And two kinds of projects are being financed by the bank. One is, of course, cross-border projects, whether in infrastructure or in other areas, whether it is cross-border road construction or railway line construction or things like that. Or we also finance projects purely at the national level but do have significant or substantial regional dimension. So these are the two kinds of projects that we finance that should help Asian integration. And of course, third, we provide, we do a limited or modest amount of research in the area of regional economic integration, and this is part of that particular research agenda that the bank has. And finally, of course, we help to strengthen their own capability, the country's own capabilities at the government and the non-government level in understanding, in helping them cooperate and coordinate projects and programs across borders, and we do conduct quite a few training programs in helping to improve their own capabilities to do these things. So to end my background, this study is third of what we call a trilogy of studies that the bank has done in the last couple of years, last 3 years actually. The first one, which I've already referred to, was the Emerging Asian Regionalism Study in 2008, and last year our sister institution in Tokyo called ADB Institute and us together produced the second of this trilogy called Infrastructure for Seamless Asia, again looking at the issues of how can the region promote regional infrastructure development and what role the bank can play in that. And this is sequel to those two studies, and the study is, as I told you, entitled Institution for Asian Integration Towards an Asian Economic Community. With that background, I now look forward to Barry giving you the details of the study. Thank you.
That was a great overview. I'm sure many of you have questions and perhaps challenges to the reasons why Asia should integrate more fully. So if you have any of those questions, please write them on the cards and pass them up.
Thank you. So thank you to Srini as well for the introduction to the study. Naturally, I agree with everything he said, except possibly for the statement that I was the one responsible for pulling all this together. Actually, as you could imagine, for an institutional product, there were a lot of people involved in the research and writing. There were, in fact, 5 core consultants. There were a lot of ADB people, many of whom Srini directed through the Office for Regional Economic Integration. And there were other consultants teaching us about what's happening in terms of institutions for regional integration in Africa or Latin America or about other topics as well. Nonetheless, somebody had to hold the pen if we were going to have a report, and that turned out to be me. And it was an interesting problem because, on the one hand, there was a lot of constructive pressure from ADB to be ambitious and to have a vision and to think out of the box. And on the other hand, there was a lot of pressure to be realistic and offer proposals with a possibility of actually being implemented. So I would put it to you, put yourself in my shoes for a moment. Imagine that the Asian Development Bank had come to you and said, what can we build to strengthen and accelerate the process of regional integration in Asia? What's ambitious and at the same time feasible? And the answer is it's not obvious, I think, but here is one effort at both the motivation and a set of proposals. Srini mentioned to you the 2 preceding reports, the excellent study on policies toward regional integration done in 2008, Emerging Asian Regionalism, the excellent study done in 2009 on infrastructure policies in particular. What can Asia do to strengthen its transportation infrastructure, its economic infrastructure, more generally to bring the constituent countries and economies of the region together? Having done that twice, this is not a third attempt to do the same thing. This report doesn't talk about policies per se, but it tries to think and talk about the institutional framework within which those policies will be formulated. Policymakers change, but for there to be continuity, there has to be a stronger institutional framework. So we ask, what kind of institutions does Asia need in order to support the process of regional integration? There are really 4 motivations for undertaking this exercise, I would argue. The first one is that while regional integration has been immensely beneficial for Asia, the what has been achieved is fragile. You go to Best Buy and you see those consumer electronics that are produced in Asia, not by China, not by one country, but through the operation of a regional supply chain, through the operation of production networks through which many different Asian countries provide the parts and components that are then shipped across borders, assembled, and sold on ultimately to consumers in the United States and elsewhere. There's an elaborate set of trading relationships and policy cooperation that lies behind that achievement, but it can't be taken for granted. The region is open to the rest of the world, and it's therefore subject to shocks from the rest of the world. And we saw that dramatically in 2008, 2009, when Asia's export trade collapsed even more dramatically through no fault of its own than it had in previous crises like the 1997-98 Asian financial crisis, the dark blue line, or the 2000-2001 high-tech crash, the yellowish line, the red line being, of course, the heart attack that occurred in 2008, 2009. So many things can go wrong, and it's important to build a robust set of institutional supports, a robust institutional architecture that can cement those gains. Secondly, it's important to broaden the process. So people sometimes talk about what I've described as factory Asia, Asian countries working together as a manufactory that ships manufacturing goods to the rest of the world. It might better be called factory East Asia. So there are important parts of the continent that have not been involved or not been as involved in this process as one would like, and have not reaped the same benefits, at least until recently, in terms of rapid growth. South Asia has not been involved. Central Asia has not been involved. The Pacific Islands have not been involved. All of those are part of the Asian Development Bank's remit. So thinking about how to broaden the process so more countries are included is a second reason for pondering Asia's institutional future. A third motivation is, again, flows from the observation that Asia is the paradigmatic open region, that whatever Asia does to strengthen its economic and political connections internally has to be compatible with strengthening those connections with the rest of the world as well. Asian countries are members of regional institutions. They're also members of global multilateral institutions, from the World Trade Organization to the International Monetary Fund to the World Bank. Compatibility is a third important imperative. And fourth, capacity, creating the capacity to undertake the next steps. So in some sense, I would argue, what has been achieved so far is the easy part, eliminating barriers to trade at the border. Going behind the border and moving toward deeper economic, financial, and who knows, someday maybe political integration will be harder still, and will require stronger institutions. So the premise of this study is that those four challenges are important, and they cannot be met by relying on market processes, letting the market solve them, or relying on national initiative alone. Rather, what will be required is Asian countries working together to, in cooperation, to meet them. And working together effectively will in turn require a set of norms, rules, and understandings about what to do. So there you have the academics, the political scientists' definition of institutions. The broadest possible definition is probably a set of norms, rules, and understandings about how to proceed. Norms, rules, and understandings that shape expectations, that govern the behavior of governments and other actors. So meeting these challenges, we argue, requires effective institutions for regionalism. There are obviously different ways of thinking about institutions, and we talk about them in a variety of different ways in the report, ranging from the academic definition I gave you a moment ago, durable rules that shape expectations, interests, and behavior that can either be informal or more formal. We use in the report itself a more focused definition, more in keeping with everyday usage. So we talk not only about informal rules, but arrangements and institutions as arrangements and organizations, ranging from ad hoc and informal forums that lack an organizational core to formal standing bodies that have a specific mandate, that serve a specific purpose. One of the things we set out to do when we began the report was to take an inventory of what are the institutions, relevant institutions that exist in Asia. That exercise quickly got out of hand. Once we sat down with pencil and paper the same afternoon, we had several hundred. So we tried to focus specifically on institutions for regionalism, organizations that are directly involved in regional economic integration and cooperation in Asia and the Pacific. And we tried to focus specifically on institutions for regionalism in which national governments are directly involved, not necessarily to the exclusion of business or other stakeholders, but we excluded other entities, organizations where that had no governmental involvement, pure NGOs, if you will. This is the inventory that resulted, given those categories. So I'll talk about this for a moment now, but we identified 55 institutions for regionalism, distinguishing them by their geographic focus. Are they trans-regional in the sense that they involve both Asia and other parts of the world? Think about APEC, for example. Are they region-wide, encompassing all parts of Asia, or do they look at a particular sub-region? So you can see the importance of those kind of institutions by looking at the size of the circle as you move from left to right. And then we distinguished institutions by their internal purpose or organization, moving top to down. Overarching institutions, which you see in the first row, are umbrella organizations, if you will, that convene summits for heads of government or state. They provide the normative frameworks that legitimate and support regional cooperation and integration. There is the Asia-Europe meeting, there is APEC, there is ASEAN plus three, ASEAN plus six. They are all, each of them are those kind of meetings that involve heads of state and government and their delegates coming together. The second row is functional institutions that are narrower, more specialized. Often they have a technical agenda. They focus on a specific area of cooperation, a specific topic, and often they have a more limited geographic focus. AMRO is an example, the ASEAN Plus 3 Macroeconomic Research Office, which provides research support and surveillance functions for the for ASEAN Plus 3 and the Chiang Mai Initiative of financial supports in particular. EMEAP is an institution that brings together central banks from Asia and the Pacific countries to talk about central banking issues. The third row is facilitating institutions that facilitate the process of regional integration by providing administrative, technical, and financial support, of which the Asian Development Bank would be a prototypical example, but there are many more. And finally, there is a handful of security institutions in the region that do security. So this being the Asian Development Bank and not the Asian Security Bank, that's the security institutions are not our focus in this report, but they are relevant. So there's, you know, the well-known hypothesis that countries that trade with one another are least likely to go to war. There are a variety of notions out there that security cooperation and economic cooperation can be complementary with one another. So the existence of these security arrangements is relevant, and the question of whether security cooperation and economic cooperation should be harmonized, should be brought together under one umbrella is relevant for our thinking as well. Back to the argument. The argument then is that this network of institutions has served Asia well, but that the next steps in regional integration will require more, will require stronger institutional support. So that brings me back to my earlier thought experiment. Put yourself in my shoes and ask yourself, how would you modify this regional architecture to better meet the challenges that I described before? Well, we want to be ambitious, but we also want to be realistic, so we need to start with a set of observations about this institutional reality. So the first observation is that these institutions have not resulted from some grand vision or grand scheme about the Asia's institutional landscape. Asian governments have proceeded in a pragmatic and flexible way. They have continually adapted their cooperative structures to changing circumstances and to the reality that Asia is a very diverse place. So much more than the obvious comparison, Europe, even. Asia is a region where there are countries with very different levels of economic development, different political systems, different priorities, which has resulted in this diverse institutional architecture, sometimes described as multi-track or multi-speed. And what has resulted has tended to bubble up from below. Asian integration has been heavily market-led, and in response to those market forces, certain institutional structures have been created. These are facts. So the second observation is, if you think about how to strengthen the region's institutional architecture, your point of departure has to be what exists. You can't ignore it or assume it away. So these institutions are the starting point, necessarily, for any effort to create a more durable institutional architecture. Another thing we did in the context of this study was to take a survey, or to commission a survey by professionals of opinion leaders in Asia, and to ask them, what kind of approaches to strengthening the region's architecture would you support? What kind of new institutions would you find attractive? So here are some answers to three questions. Would you strongly agree on the desirability of strengthening the region's existing institutions? And that's on the left. The big orange portion of the bar indicates strong support, stronger support than exists for creating new institutions on the far right. And naturally, the intermediate alternative of consolidating the existing institutions, making them work more effectively together, has an intermediate level of support between those two extremes. If you ask opinion leaders in Asia, what kind of new institutions would you find attractive? At the top, institutions that would deal with concrete policy problems like financial instability and governing capital flows, an Asian financial stability dialogue where regulators and policymakers and others get together to do that, is viewed quite positively. And European-style institutions whose exact purpose in the Asian context would be less clear, an Asian parliament, an Asian commission, an Asian court of justice, are viewed considerably less positively. Pragmatic, flexible, and all that seems to come through here as well. A third observation is that most of Asia's institutions for regionalism are intergovernmental. They're heavily dominated by governments as the principal players or stakeholders who get together and negotiate arrangements. Decisions are generally taken by consensus. Everyone has to agree, or everyone at the end of negotiations has to be too tired to violently disagree in order for the process to move forward. There are some exceptions to those rules. You see cases where regional institutions like ASEAN have been willing to delegate, governments have been willing to delegate to others responsibility for certain functions, and cases like the Chiang Mai initiative where governments have been willing to proceed by qualified majority vote rather than by unanimity where time is of the essence, as in financial matters, for example. But broadly speaking, there is this thing called the ASEAN way, which means governments get together and negotiate, and they proceed by consensus without reaching decisions that some participants might violently object to. And finally, a fourth observation is that many obligations for governments are created in the course of these negotiations, but they're not always implemented uniformly and effectively across the region. So this may always be the case of intergovernmental agreements, but it may be even truer in Asia than elsewhere, because the capacity of governments in societies and economies at very different levels of economic and internal institutional development to implement may in turn be very different. So from our point of view, those are the facts that need to be respected by any set of proposals about what to do next. So given those facts and given what we're trying to achieve here, we offer two general principles for reform and then four specific recommendations. I will describe them, Madam Chairman, and then I will stop. So the first principle is Asian countries need to, and in building institutions, Asian countries need to make the most of existing global institutions and conventions. So imagine that the problem in Asia is to further liberalize trade by relaxing barriers behind the border and strengthening intellectual property protection. We already have a global institution called the World Trade Organization designed to do that. Why not make more effective use of WTO commitments in trying to solve the region's problems? You talk to business people in the region and they say uncertainty about contract enforcement, about the enforcement of contracts between two businesses in different countries, is an obstacle to the further development of these regional supply chains and production networks and so forth. There already exists a United Nations Convention on contracts for the international sale of goods, the CISG, that scores of countries around the world have signed up to, but only a handful of Asian countries have. So that's another example about how Asia could solve its regional problems by making better use of global institutions and conventions. And there are many other examples of the same thing, I think, that could be cited. For example, how to govern regional financial markets is a big issue, given what we've just been through. There's a set of global institutions designed in principle to solve that problem, the Basel Committee of Banking Supervisors and the Financial Stability Board, of which Asian countries are now members. Why not solve the region's problems of governing financial markets and institutions by making better use of those global institutions? And the second general principle is that the legitimacy of Asia's regional institutions, the respect in which they're held by the public, and their effectiveness all could be enhanced by providing more information about their activities and encouraging more civil society input into their deliberations. So each of the institutions, 55 institutions I referred to before, almost all of them now have websites. We all do. But they provide, some of them, limited information about their activities. They could do better. They could establish independent compliance boards made up of business and academic non-governmental members who could independently monitor whether the governments that are party to these institutions are actually following up on their commitments. So governments tell you how they think they're doing in terms of meeting their commitments under these arrangements. Why not have an independent body monitor that? And more generally, I would argue that Asia is approaching the limits of the effectiveness of a purely intergovernmental approach where it needs to do more to encourage non-governmental stakeholders in the process, civil society members who support the goals of regional integration. So we then offer four specific recommendations for institutional reform, which range from the relatively modest and straightforward first to the significantly more ambitious last. So the first one, which is modest in its formulation, but I think will require ambition in execution, is to strengthen the existing sub-regional institutions. So every part of Asia has an institution or two of its own. Southeast Asia has ASEAN, South Asia has SARC, one could go on. These existing institutions could be identified with and pursue a specific core competency or function. Each one could be clearer for itself and for its stakeholders about what exactly it's trying to achieve. So I think some of Asia's institutions have been better at this than others. ASEAN Plus 3 has done a good job in this respect. It's kind of carved out a responsibility for managing the region's financial affairs. What is the core competency of the other institutions in the region? Building that, an effective competency, will require the intellectual and administrative capacity, not just seconding a mid-level bureaucrat from each country, but building a standing secretariat that can set an agenda, that can provide the analytical documents that leaders need in order to go forward in that area. It would help to have clear and objective membership rules for each of these organizations. Can outsiders opt in, and under what circumstances? And it would be it would be useful for each of the sub-regional institutions to work at developing more effective links with the others. Second, there is a role for specialized functional sub-regional institutions and for the creation of new ones. So an example would be the Greater Mekong Subregion, made up of that group of countries that through which the Mekong flows or that border on the Mekong River, that use it as a transportation hub and network, that not only have harmonized their regulations about how to do that, but have begun to build links from the Mekong to the economic interior. The Greater Mekong subregion has been quite effective now in doing that and has moved to other kinds of transport links, rail links, highway links, and so forth. So those are the kind of things that other subregions could reasonably do as well. And one can imagine a variety of other high priority functional opportunities here in areas like health, disaster management, student exchanges that could be usefully pursued. Third, we argue for the desirability of creating an Asian Regional Advisory Council. You can see from this awkward name that there has been some considerable discussion about what to call this thing that would help national courts implement in a uniform and effective way their obligations. So this would be a new institution composed of experts in international commercial and business law in the first instance, who would, at the request of national courts or administrative agencies, the national regulator or court would have to ask for opinions and advice about how to implement international conventions and obligations in a way that is consistent with what other countries are doing. And finally, we argue for the desirability of moving forward now on proposals that have been offered by the Prime Minister of Australia, the President of Korea, the now former Prime Minister of Japan, to create an encompassing pan-regional institution, a council of Asia, I think I would call it, that would be the umbrella institution for the entire region. I think that is desirable for several reasons. This would be the one institution in which all Asian countries would be involved, where you could assure all Asian countries would be assured of having a voice. There are countries that are not involved in any consequential regional institution yet. There are countries that are involved in some but feel left out of others. Here is a venue where they would have voice. This would be an institution for better coordinating the initiatives of the various subregions. It would be a place where both security cooperation and economic cooperation could be discussed. So if there are synergies or positive spillovers between them, they could be exploited. Some of Asia's challenges are pan-regional in nature, climate change, epidemics. So it would be desirable and efficient, presumably, to have a pan-regional institution to address them. Srini referred to the desirability of Asian countries speaking with a single voice more loudly and more effectively in global economic fora, and a Council of Asia could be a place to hammer out what those with the single voice would effectively be saying. So that's our bottom line. The point is that regional integration has been tremendously beneficial for Asia. It has been a largely bottom-up process, driven first by the market and then by negotiations among national governments. The argument here is that will not be enough going forward. It remains to solidify recent gains, to make the process inclusive, so countries that haven't participated fully can, and to move ahead to the next steps of deeper integration, and doing all those things will require, in our view, building a stronger and more effective institutional framework. So with that, I think we will both be happy to take your questions.
Thank you. Given the fact that we're pressed for time, we can stay, if the panelists agree, 10 minutes over. And so I'll just go ahead with the questions. So I sort of grouped the questions. There's a series of really interesting questions about Asian regional integration and the European Union. So we'll start with those, and then we'll talk a little bit about member country interests and some interesting issues surrounding that. So one of the first questions, and we've had several questions in this vein, is what are the major similarities and major differences between the between Asian integration and the European Union, and what can Asia learn from the EU, and should the EU be a model given how diverse Asia is, how large Asia is, and can we learn anything from can we learn anything about risks to economic integration given what's happening with Greece at the moment?
You want to start? Doesn't matter. All right, we're going to have this perennial problem. It has long been my view that Europe and Asia are different, and recent nothing that has happened recently would make me change my mind on that. I do think that while European integration has also has a heavy economic component, as in Asia, it's been driven also by a political agenda ever since World War II. So the it will not come as a surprise to any of you if I say that the same appetite for political integration on the part of regional leaders doesn't exist in Asia. So I think the two processes are very different. Even in Europe, we've seen that deep economic and especially monetary integration without political integration is problematic. So if you take that as the lesson of the crisis in Greece and elsewhere in Southern Europe, and I do take that as one of the lessons, that suggests that Asia needs to be cautious about what kinds of integration it proceeds with. Trade integration is much safer than monetary integration and then deep financial integration as well in the absence of significant steps toward political integration.
You're correct. I mean, one line lesson from Greece is that we now know that the institutional requirements for deeper integration are even more stringent or even more compelling than what we once thought. So for a while we thought that you can run a monetary union with common monetary policy but need not necessarily impose the same restriction on fiscal policy. But it seems that there has problems. So obviously you need more institutional arrangement which can then introduce more fiscal discipline among the member states of even a purely monetary union. So that's a great lesson for us. So if anybody in Asia is thinking that we could leapfrog into a monetary union with somewhat less stringent institutional arrangements, that we are mistaken. So in other words, it makes the case for stronger institutions in Asia even stronger.
So the next series of questions will have to do with sovereignty and interests. So given what you said about Asian integration being sort of less deep than what we see with European integration, how do you manage sovereignty issues in this process? How do you manage the idea that to deepen some of these institutions or to create pan-institutions that there will have to be some delegation of authority to international bodies? And then how do you, I guess within that, another sort of related question that someone else had was, how do you manage then the expectations of citizens in that process?
So when I began to work with ADB on this project, everything I read and everyone I talked to reminded me of the great delicacy of sovereignty issues in Asia, where the issue is much more delicate than in the European context, for example, where I had worked before. Having worked on this project now for some time, I am impressed, on the other hand, by the willingness of Asian governments to delegate. It seems to be increasing over time. Where the advantages, efficiency advantages of doing so are significant. So the best example I can give is the one I gave before. Things in bad things in financial markets can happen overnight, and it may not be feasible to fix them or solve them if you have to get the unanimous consent of everybody involved. It may be necessary to move more quickly than that on the basis of a qualified majority. And the Asian countries that have put real money on the barrelhead now as part of their Chiang Mai initiative are prepared to proceed in that way. So I think there is a recognition, maybe the right way of putting it is sometimes pooling sovereignty makes the sovereign more effective in terms of being able to do, you know, what it is trying to achieve.
Do you have anything to add?
No, it's fine.
Okay, the next question is on interests. So how do you balance the interests of different Asian countries? Are there certain countries that stand to gain more from economic integration or economic and political integration? And there were several questions asking how do you balance you have two very large Asian powers, China and India. And you can add Japan to that as well. And then you have the U.S. and what the U.S. interests and how could that possibly become a factor in how Asia integrates?
Well, on the role of the U.S. in all this is a complicated one. You noted from the diagram with all the little circles on it that there are trans-regional and regional institutions, both. So as we approach the period where I guess the U.S. will have the chairmanship of APEC, this will become a more prominent issue. Once again, I think that, and here I speak as an individual, certainly, and not anyone affiliated with the Asian Development Bank. My sense is that there is a growing desire in Asia to create, in addition to existing structures, which are either sub-regional or trans-regional, like APEC, a real Asian institution that can deal with problems that are Asia-specific. So the United States is a Pacific power, but not an Asian power. Is that the language we should choose in this context? So there is a role for institutions that bring together Pacific and Asian countries. And then there is a role, it seems to me, for Asian, I almost shouldn't use the word purely, exclusively Asian institutions to address mainly Asian problems and to try to structure them in a way that is open to the rest of the world.
So I'm actually going to get back to a little the sovereignty question again, because it was a little bit glossed over. So one of the more interesting questions was, do you believe that Asian countries need to be democracies to legitimate this process? And if they're not, how do you legitimate the process? How does this process become legitimate if countries which are not democracies are joining into to this process and giving up some sovereignty or delegating some sovereignty to international institutions?
I should leave that. That is a hard one. If you look at the in the European context, countries have to adopt the acquis of the European community, where they become democracies and they accept Western Europe's definitions of respecting human rights and so forth. Asia is not at that place. I think at one level, economic cooperation is legitimated by the economic benefits, and especially if the economic benefits are widely shared, that they don't accrue simply to business owners or whomever. So that's a limited answer. As an economist, I would like to think that these economic links to the rest of the world that are built through this process have desirable political effects as well, but that's another conversation.
I can just add a little thing on that. I think some of these issues will need to be addressed when you look at or develop or set up new pan-Asian institutions of one form or the other, which will fall under our last recommendation. These are details as to what kind of membership rules or specifications will be introduced when you actually establish one, what stipulations will you expect countries to fulfill, whether you should have a Western-style democracies among the member countries to be a member of that pan-Asian institution, or you have only non-political or only economic conditions or conditionalities for membership. I think these are issues of detail. But just to mention one experience that we already have in Asia, the East Asian countries have already worked, at least until now, without putting in that extra condition, yet they are doing a reasonably good job of integration or cooperation. Take the ASEAN Plus 3 initiative we have, without calling it so, we already have the embryonic Asian Monetary Fund almost in place there. It's just a matter of putting that name on that and then, you know, strengthening it in that direction. You have the multilateralization of the Chiang Mai Initiative. We now have the ASEAN Pacific countries have decided to set up the surveillance, regional surveillance unit. And once these things start functioning, I think we have already an embryonic Asian Monetary Fund without democracy being mentioned anywhere. So I think the way Asia would perhaps progress would be trying to do what is feasible without really opening the Pandora's box, if you can. And then, of course, at a certain stage, maybe that cannot be done. And then I think it will perhaps be able to be addressed.
I think it will have to be addressed at some point. Mm-hmm. So are there certain countries that stand to gain more from increased economic integration? Are there some countries that are more vulnerable?
The benefits of integration, I think it's very, very obvious. It won't have everybody getting proportional benefits or proportional costs. Certainly, there will be winners and quote-unquote losers in the process. But what we have seen, I think, generally speaking, is that regional integration is generally good for all the countries involved. And as we have developed this theme in the 2008 publication, our one-line conclusion is that, in general, it is good for the countries, good for the region, Asia, and good for the world. Now, that said, certainly there will be, whenever you do a macro statement of that nature, there will certainly be microeconomic adjustment that some countries will have to do, some companies will have to do, some sectors will perhaps have to do. That is unavoidable. So at the end of the day, that adjustment process cannot be avoided as Asia integrates. There will be, I'm sure, for example, when you integrate in trade and production, I'm sure some countries would find it difficult to compete with somebody who had just come into the game. So that micro adjustment, what I would call a micro adjustment, cannot therefore be avoided. So, but at the end of it, of course, it forces adjustment on countries. It may look as if it's a pain, but over the longer term, I think that's good for them, that little pain perhaps. Then, of course, the issue of how to compensate the losers, in the process. Now, that is an issue that Asia will have to address. What kind of institutional mechanism or will Asia need to develop in terms of making this adjustment as smooth as we can, not avoiding the adjustment, but managing the adjustment? What kind of institutional mechanism can be developed to balance the winners and losers and how to compensate, if you will?
Thank you. So one last question, since we're basically out of time, but I thought that this was a great wrap-up question. So what are the primary risks for the global economy if Asian integration does not move ahead as your report proposes? What if it stays sort of superficial and some would say more flexible, right? Because they're coming, different institutions come together for different reasons, and in a diverse region, that model could be seen as more flexible, more pragmatic. So what do you think the risks are if Asia doesn't move along this path?
Well, I think, as I said before, I think what Asia has achieved is fragile and can't be taken for granted. So we've seen an example of how things can go off the rails in Europe. They wouldn't go off the rails in the same way in Asia, but serious trade disputes resulting from commercial conflict or political conflict between the countries of the region that caused the one engine of the world economy that's beating strongly at the moment to stop beating would be a bad thing for all of us.
I just thought it's a good question. I think one line answer is if Asia doesn't integrate effectively in the years, in the decades to come, both Asia and the world will be losers. Because Asia will lose, because then, you know, you have these small countries not gaining the scale economies that will be theirs if they actually integrate. We have seen it once China has entered the production network. We have seen how all the countries, including the ASEAN countries, who were very apprehensive in the initial stages, have just benefited. So it's been good for the countries and good for the region. And hence, if Asia actually dither on integration, Asia will certainly lose. And I think from the global economic perspective, if Asia doesn't do well, so will the global economy. And especially now that Asia has a very large share in the global economy, if a big component of a global economy is languishing, not doing well, the answer is very clear. The world will lose too. Thank you.
So thank you, and unfortunately we're out of time. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council and the Asia Foundation, I'd like to thank our panelists, Dr. Eichengreen and Dr. Mathur, as well as the ADB for their thoughts and insights. I'd also like to thank you for your participation. If you'd like more information, there are additional copies of the study available in the lobby from the ADB. And if you haven't already, there's boxed lunches. I think there's only turkey left. So unfortunately, if you wanted roast beef or vegetarian, it's not there. But please pick one up. So thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you.